Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. On today's show, legislative boundaries are changing following the 2020 census. What could that mean for some incumbent representatives? And later, Fresno poet Maider Vang tells us about her new collection, Yellow Rain. But first, a plaque outside an unassuming brown building near the Wawona Hotel in Yosemite reads Chinese Laundry. For years, few people knew anything about it, but now the stories of how Chinese immigrants were instrumental in establishing the park's infrastructure are coming to life. KVPR's Sarith Hawk has this story.
Ranger Adam Ramsey, the supervisor for Wawona District Interpretation, was one of the researchers who pored over archives in Yosemite's library to find names and dates connected to the Chinese Laundry building.
So the first thing that people see when they walk in are these first exhibits here.
Inside are exhibits and some artifacts detailing the early history of Chinese immigrants in Yosemite.
The building was originally constructed as a laundry facility for the Wawona Hotel.
The laundry operated from 1918 to the early 1930s. The people who worked here were primarily Chinese immigrants who came to California during the gold rush. The building itself has been restored and was just rededicated and unveiled in October. Ramsey says the goal when it reopens in April is to recreate the interior to look like a laundry facility from the time period. Many of the details came from a member of the Washburn family who established the Wawona community. The family hired mostly Chinese immigrants, and the daughter of the hotel owner, Wawona Washburn, kept detailed journals.
First-hand accounts of what it was like in this building. Wawona Washburn very specifically writing that she watched them taking irons off of a wood-burning stove and using them to iron clothes and sheets.
Those very same stoves are still here, but looking much different.
You can see they're in kind of a rough state. They were sitting outside for decades.
Ramsey believes the stoves may have been outside for as long as 80 years. The stoves will be restored as part of next year's project. In another corner of the exhibit, a large and sturdy wooden handcart is sectioned off. Ramsey says it's an example of what many Chinese immigrants used to build some of Yosemite's main roads.
You can get from Fresno to Yosemite Valley in less than 3 hours because Chinese workers hauled this cart around and tools and built it all by hand. Pretty amazing.
That's another big part of Yosemite's untold history. The hundreds of Chinese workers who built main roads like Tioga and Wawona.
The whole route between here and Yosemite Valley is just this really improbable, twisty, turvy road.
Ramsey says these workers built the road during the winter using blasting powder and hand tools such as pickaxes and shovels, and finished it in just 4.5 months.
The speed at which they pulled it off, I think, is a real testament to the skill of the workers who did this.
Honoring memories was the driving force that helped fund this history project. 86-year-old Sandra Yi and her husband donated the first pot of money that was used to start the project.
I just feel so great to be part of that.
Yi recalled her family's deep history with Yosemite. Her parents were Chinese immigrants who ran a small grocery business during the Depression. Yi says after saving up enough money to take their first family vacation, her father decided to go to Yosemite.
He just was blown away by how majestic and how magnificent Yosemite was.
It was then, Yi says, Yosemite became a huge part of her family's life.
He swore from that year on that he was going to return to Yosemite every single summer. And you know, he did.
Yi says her dad eventually saved enough money to buy a small cabin in Yosemite, and the laundry building was something she always passed by.
There was this building that was completely neglected at the beginning of the road. And we were told then that it was a Chinese laundry.
Yi credits some of Yosemite's rangers like Yen Yen Chan, who did detailed research on the Chinese in Yosemite. Yi says she knew it was a project she wanted to be a part of. As members of the Yosemite Conservancy, Yi and her husband were able to make an impact with donations.
My husband and I wanted to do something not only to commemorate my parents' love for Yosemite and the legacy they left for our family, but also to memorialize the Chinese, the, you know, early Chinese who did such monumental work.
A former California State Park superintendent, Jack Hsu, found out about the hidden history 10 years ago in a video by the Yosemite Conservancy, a nonprofit partner that funds special projects.
The Chinese first arrived here in great numbers in 1848.
And that video said so much about the Chinese contributions that I had never heard about.
He was also inspired to make an annual pilgrimage in Yosemite.
I made a commitment to at least hike up Sing Peak 10 times.
Sing Peak is named after a famous backcountry chef, Tai Singh, who was pivotal to the park's history, hosting dignitaries who came to visit. The 10th hike will happen next summer when Hsu turns 70.
People expect to have the pilgrimage now. They anticipate it. They want to have it to happen again.
Hsu says he now feels more a part of the park's history.
And I believe it does have an effect on how all Americans see Chinese Americans, that we're not foreigners, that Chinese have been a part of the fabric of this country, have contributed towards it for many, many generations.
A Yosemite spokesperson says it's the park's responsibility and privilege to retell the stories of those who worked and found a new life here. A future project will focus on the narratives of Buffalo soldiers, black soldiers segregated in the U.S. Army who established many of the backcountry trails still used today. For KVPR News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The clock is ticking to redraw legislative boundaries following the 2020 census. This week, California's Redistricting Commission released a preliminary map of what the state's congressional districts could look like. If finalized, the new map could make it a lot more difficult for some incumbent representatives, like Devin Nunes, to hold on to their seats. To learn more about this process and its timeline, I checked in with the nonprofit California Common Cause. Here's my conversation with the organization's executive director, Jonathan Metas-Stein, and Central Valley Redistricting organizer, Luis Huerta-Silva.
Jonathan, I'll go ahead and start with you. You know, we're in the public comment phase of the redistricting process, and I'm wondering if you could just explain why this part of the process is so important.
Different local jurisdictions, different cities, counties, school boards, and so on are at different places in their redistricting processes. But a lot of them are hitting the peak period right now. There is a new state law called the Fair Maps Act that requires that cities and counties, when they redraw their district lines, keep communities of interest together. Communities of interest are a city or county's networks, neighborhoods, communities that share interests, histories, racial or ethnic identities, languages, needs, and so on. And a city or a county can only keep its communities of interest together in compliance with the state law if community members come forward and talk about what their communities are and where they live. And so it's actually really, really important, not just for the reason we've always known redistricting is important, because it shapes representation and power in our local politics for the next decade, but also because the state law for the first time creates a platform for communities to be heard. And we need community leaders and community organizations to step forward and seize that opportunity.
Well, Luis, you're doing organizing work here in the Central Valley. How are things going on the ground? How engaged is the local community in this process so far?
There's obviously robust participation throughout the state. However, still there remain concerns that have been expressed in various jurisdictions through public comment or through advocacy efforts of historically discluding or not including communities that belong to what the Fair Maps Act is looking to address how farm working communities, hard to count communities, Spanish speaking communities, Black communities, immigrant communities have traditionally been discluded from these public processes. And so concerns have been continually brought up across jurisdictions. And people are saying, we're tired of not being heard, and we're ensuring that we're continuing to maintain presence at these public hearings to ensure that it is on the record now that we feel unheard, we feel not represented in our current maps, and we are looking to do something about it. And we're utilizing the Fair Maps Act as a conduit for these advocacy efforts.
Let's talk specifically about the congressional maps. The California Redistricting Commission recently released preliminary maps of what these new districts could look like. And if they are approved, they could potentially really shake up some of the Valley's congressional races. Jonathan, what jumped out to you about these preliminary maps?
What's striking is that the state commission is not relying on the past when drawing its maps. It is not saying, well, this is the way it's always been done, and so we have to start with that and tinker around the edges. They are taking a blank page, brand new sort of look, and really reacting to the community testimony that they've heard from the public. There have been thousands and thousands and thousands of public submissions, both written submissions and oral testimony from the public. And this commission is remarkably willing to be guided by that public participation. But what it means is that the powers that be may be in for a shakeup.
You know, we live in a moment where it feels like all politics is national, but we know that it's what happens at the local level that has the most impact on our lives. So, Luis, what's happening with redistricting efforts on sort of, you know, the Board of Supervisors level or the city council level or school boards? I mean, what should we be paying attention to?
Well, right now throughout the Central Valley, jurisdictions are presenting their draft maps already. And some even have self-imposed deadlines, I may add, as early as November 16th. And so what we're seeing is community groups, again, continuing to recognize, yes, it's been a quick process due to a pandemic. However, it does not deter the fact that we need to include robust participation per the Fair Maps Act. Community members continue to voice their advocacy efforts also on issues of the commission as a whole, or its the composition of these commissions. And they're looking towards pushing for independent commissions that listen to the community testimony and prioritize community testimony that unfortunately is not being felt in these public hearings, that especially that now that they were presenting their draft maps, they feel that their communities of interest testimonies are being ignored. And so what community members are doing is continuing to rev up their involvement in this process to ensure that, again, on the record, we have what communities of interest look like for Southeast Fresno, what communities of interest look like for Kings County, et cetera.
Jonathan, did you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, what we're really worried about is incumbent politicians at the local level who say, well, we know that the Fair Maps Act requires us to listen to community and keep communities of interest whole in our new district maps, but we're assuming not enough people are paying attention and there's not any real public oversight over our work. And so we're going to draw maps that prioritize keeping us in office and we'll assume no one's going to catch us. That's the real fear. The law only works if someone is paying attention, if community is engaged, and you can hold local decision makers accountable. And our fear is that everyone has to be engaged at every local level of government in order to make that real.
Could you just continue on then and explain what comes next? I mean, we're still in this process of you know, public hearings being held. We have some preliminary maps that have been released or are in the process of being released. When is this all going to be finalized, and how can people get involved?
Any local jurisdiction, whether it's a city or a county, that uses the primary election, so in this case, the June 2022 primary election, they have a state law deadline to complete their redistricting process of December 15th of this year. Though some jurisdictions and some counties are using a self-imposed earlier deadline. Those cities, often smaller or medium-sized cities that don't use the primary and their next election is the November 2022 general election, they have until April of next year to complete their redistricting process. So for a lot of jurisdictions, the hearings that are going to determine what maps are used and what power looks like in local government for the next 10 years, those hearings are happening now. And so people need to go to their local community organization that's engaged or go to their city website or their county website and figure out when the next hearing is coming. Take a look at the draft maps that have been released and find whether it slices and dices the community or whether it actually does the work it's supposed to do to empower community and create fair and equitable representation. And then go to the next meeting and make your voices heard.
Well, I've been talking with Jonathan Mehta-Stein and Luis Huerta Silva with California Common Cause. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. For more than two decades, the small Tulare County community of Tuleyville has been without a secure supply of safe drinking water. The simplest solution would be to connect the town's water system to that of its neighbor, the city of Exeter. It would take less than a mile of pipe to get it done, but years of red tape and failed negotiations have kept the consolidation from taking place. Now the state has stepped in with a new law, SB 403, which could bring safe drinking water to Tuleyville and hundreds of communities like it throughout the Central Valley. To learn more, I spoke to Michael Claiborne, directing attorney for the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. It's really easy to understand why Tuleyville would want to consolidate its water system with Exeter. Why has Exeter been so resistant?
That's a really good question. And I think a lot of it goes back to history. So the community of Tuleyville is just outside the city of Exeter. It's 0.7 miles away. And it's historically been and continues to be a community of color, home to largely low-income farm workers. And there's been a reluctance on the part of the city of Exeter to extend drinking water service past its own boundaries and provide drinking water service to its neighbor. I think the city of Exeter would say or have said that the city has its own problems and it has limited staff to deal with those problems. So taking on an additional community in terms of drinking water service has been something they've been reluctant to do. The community of Tuleyville approached the city of Exeter back in 2001 to start a conversation around consolidation. And there have been a number of issues that the city has raised since then that it believed prevented a consolidation. At the beginning, the issue that the city had raised was that it was a charter city, and under state law, extending drinking water service outside of its city limits may have jeopardized that status as a charter city. There was actually a law passed in 2008 or 2009 to address that and resolve that issue. And then since then, they've raised, I think, another number of other barriers, some of which are legitimate, like the need to address its own drinking water system. However, at the same time, the state has offered funding and incentives to try to overcome those barriers. And there's yet to be an agreement for consolidation that would solve the drinking water problems in the community of Tuleyville.
And just to be clear, what's happening in Tuleyville, it's not unique to that community. There's communities like this throughout the Central Valley. Is that right?
Throughout the Central Valley and throughout the state, there's a drinking water crisis in this state. There's hundreds of thousands of Californians that lack access to safe drinking water because of contamination in a water system, because of contamination in private domestic wells, and because of dry wells, because of overpumping of groundwater. So this is definitely not a unique situation in the community of Tooleyville. It's a statewide problem.
Okay, so what is the state doing to solve it? I know there's recently been the passage of SB 403. Could you just explain what that bill could mean for these communities?
I think backing up a little bit, just to provide some context, the state of California in 2012 recognized that access to safe and affordable drinking water is a human right. And there have been a lot of efforts since then to try to make that a reality for households and communities throughout the state. I think one of the more visible efforts has been to secure funding for drinking water solutions. And at this point, a lot of that funding has been secured that's needed to address drinking water problems. There's $650 million in this year's state budget alone to address drinking water. The problem is that funding is really only half the battle for a lot of communities. The other issue is really local politics that can get in the way of solutions in communities like Tooleyville. And to try to get around those local politics, there have been a number of past policy efforts to try to establish legal tools that would allow the state to mandate consolidation of water systems, mandate two water systems joining together to try to solve drinking water problems. In 2015, there was a law called SB 88, and that law allows the state water board, under current law, to order two water systems to consolidate where one consistently fails to provide an adequate supply of safe drinking water. So where one water system has already failed. The problem with that law is it's really reactive. It doesn't allow the state to proactively mandate consolidation or facilitate consolidation. Instead, it requires the state water board to wait until there's already a drinking water crisis and then react to it by mandating a consolidation. In a lot of communities like Tooleyville that have had consistent failures to provide safe drinking water for decades, those problems can be intermittent. So in Tooleyville, for example, they've had nitrate contamination off and on since 1978. And most recently, they have contamination with a chemical called hexavalent chromium. That's a carcinogen. Because of a lawsuit in 2017, that carcinogen is unregulated. So it wasn't clear that the state water board could mandate consolidation between the city of Exeter and Tooleyville over the last several years because they weren't technically out of compliance with any drinking water standard, any maximum contaminant level. So I think what we saw and what the author of SB 403 saw, Senator Lena Gonzalez, is that there's a need to act more proactively for water systems that are at risk of failing.
So where do things stand for Tooleyville now? I understand that there are some negotiations that have restarted with Exeter. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. In August of this year, the State Water Board sent a letter to both Tooleyville and the city of Exeter after one of Tooleyville's two wells stopped producing in the summer, failed because of falling groundwater levels, and subsequently they were able to restart that well. But the State Water Board felt that because of that well failure and the history of contamination, Tooleyville met the current standard of consistently failing to provide an adequate supply of safe drinking water, and sent a letter requesting that both Tooleyville and the city of Exeter restart negotiations around a voluntary consolidation. Since that letter went out, there have been, I think, four meetings now between Tooleyville and the city of Exeter trying to negotiate a voluntary consolidation. And I have a lot of optimism that those talks are going to result in ultimately a voluntary agreement to consolidate.
You know, it's really easy, I would think, for somebody listening to this to say to themselves, if you're in a community where there's no clean drinking water, just move. But I don't think it is that simple for people who live in communities like Tooleyville.
No, it's absolutely not that easy. I think a couple things. The first is that no one should have to leave the community where they've lived and grown up and raised families because of an entirely solvable drinking water problem. So that's the first thing. And then the second is we hear from community residents every day that if given the choice, maybe they would move to a community that has safe drinking water. Oftentimes that choice is not available to people because the affordable housing is in the community they're in now. And they couldn't afford to, say, for example, in the Tuleyville situation, move from Tuleyville to the city of Exeter.
It just seems to me unfathomable that it is 2021 and we live in a state where, what are the estimates, roughly 1 million people are in communities where they don't have reliable access to clean drinking water. Do you think that these steps that the state is now making will finally be a solution to that problem? And if so, how long is it going to take? Or, I mean, can you just give us a sense of how realistic is it that this extraordinarily huge problem is finally going to be solved?
Yeah, it's a massive problem and it's going to take time to solve. There are more than 300 drinking water systems in the state that are currently providing unsafe drinking water. And then there's another more than 600 systems in the state that the state water board has identified as being at risk of failing to provide an adequate supply of safe drinking water. So to make progress, I think two things are needed. The first is to provide solutions to the communities and households that already have unsafe drinking water or lack water altogether because a well has failed. But the second is that we need to act more proactively by investing in these at-risk water systems, either through a consolidation or by providing funds needed to make sure that those water systems are sustainable. If we don't act proactively, we're really on a treadmill. We're not making progress on a statewide level. Even if we make progress on a community level, the State Water Board has estimated that 47 water systems every year, new water systems go out of compliance. And until we bring that number down, it's going to be hard to make progress.
I've been talking with Michael Claiborne, directing attorney with the Leadership Council. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. In 2014, the state legislature passed the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, known as SGMA, with the goal of balancing the amount of water flowing out of and into underground aquifers. How that would actually work was left up to the hundreds of local water agencies, who are now beginning to receive feedback from the state on their sustainability plans. To get an update on what to expect as SGMA continues to roll out, KVPR's Carrie Klein spoke with Lois Henry, the CEO and editor of sjvwater.org.
And so in the earlier years after this law was passed, you know, the state divided itself up into these groundwater sustainability agencies, or GSAs. We'll be using that acronym a lot. And then a few years ago, each GSA was required to submit a plan to the state known as a GSP, another acronym. So what are some of the examples, Lois, of projects that were included in some of these GSPs from around this area in the San Joaquin Valley? You know, how creative are some of the solutions in terms of balancing groundwater usage?
There's only really two valves that you can turn to balance groundwater usage, and that is turn some mythical valve on that creates more water, or turn the valve off for usage, which means less pumping. So these GSPs, the groundwater sustainability plans, are out there. These are 1,000-page documents from each area, and they list everything that you can do within the realms of those two things I just listed. Madera County has taken over what's known as the Whitelands in its region. And just so that, to sort of acclimate people, Whitelands are areas that are outside of established water districts. Literally on maps, they are in white, whereas opposed to districts are in pink or blue or yellow or green. So Madera County has taken over those areas. And the significant thing about Whitelands is, being outside of a district, they don't get any surface water. They don't get water from Millerton Reservoir or the Delta, or typically, usually even river water. These are really plant and pump areas. So they have a lot more groundwater usage, and taking over management of those areas, it becomes very dire because there is no way to really bring in a lot more water unless you you know, start the whole infrastructure game where you build canals and you build recharge basins, et cetera. So Madera County is facing a really significant issue, and they have created a situation where they are going to be going to pumping restrictions, and it's tiered over time. It starts to increase, and they're establishing rates for pumping, and they're trying to establish a groundwater market. So they're pretty far along in doing some of these things. And, you know, it's been, you know, a lot of hue and cry and gnashing of teeth up there in Madera County. So, so you've got that, then you've got, say, you know, the Tulare Lake Basin area, which is Kings County. And in that basin, the GSP, they have, I think, what, 7 GSAs, but they put together one GSP. It gets really complicated because you can do this in multiple different ways. But in Kings County, they have 7 GSAs that all had to write their own chapter, essentially. But then they put together one GSP, Groundwater Sustainability Plan. And I've written about that plan numerous times because it is fascinating to me that they listed a number of what are known as management actions, you know, and those are, oh, we're going to reduce pumping, or we're going to increase fees to disincentivize pumping, or we're going to bring in more water from this source. So that's what a management action is. Management meaning this is how we're going to manage our deficit, our groundwater deficit. And in that plan, they list a number of management actions one could take if one were so inclined to take such a management action. But they didn't list, like, this is what we're going to do. This is how much it's going to cost. This is how we're going to pay for it. This is the benefit we anticipate from this management action. So they really listed just sort of a, you know, a laundry list of things that could happen. And the first time I read it, and I wrote about it in February of 2020, when they, right after they filed it, my first line was, I can't imagine DWR, the Department of Water Resources, accepting this. And since that time, DWR has come out with assessments of 4 GSPs. 2 of them were considered deficient, and one of them was in the Cuyama Valley. That's the closest to my region. So I read it because my life is nothing but reading this stuff. But anyway, I live a very boring life. And it was very, very clear that the deficiencies were basically like, hey, GSP, you list all of these undesirable actions, or, you know, these different things that happen, but you don't get into any detail about how you're going to fix them. You know, that's what these GSPs are for. How are you going to fix this? So I just can't imagine DWR saying, hey, sure, no problem, Tulare Lake Basin, one could do these management actions. Yes, that's true. But no, they're going to want way more detail. So
that's very interesting. And as you said, that these are multi-hundred page documents. Some of them are almost 1,000 pages. And so there is really quite a lot of detail in there, at least ostensibly, for a lot of these plans. I mean, even to the level of, you know, they include what they consider, you know, a minimum allowable, you know, water threshold for how deep they will allow the water table to fall before some other corrective action needs to be taken, things like that. So these are the kinds of details that are in these plans.
Yes, they get very detailed. But if you read those GSPs, you'll also notice that there's a lot of repetition. And I mean, to a certain extent, they're adhering to what the government has required them to do. You know, it's sort of like the old how to write a paper. You're gonna tell people what you're gonna tell them, then you're gonna tell them, and then you're gonna tell them what you told them. So it's a little bit of that, which makes it really frustrating to get through them.
Yes, indeed. Which is also part of the reason that a lot of folks feel a little bit disenfranchised, because if they want to get involved in the process, there is just so much information and so many words to wade through to sort of get involved and to have a stake in this. And so, as you said, the Department of Water Resources is getting back and starting to issue feedback. So that's the step that they're on now, correct? That now the state is coming back with feedback to approve or deny or to add comments on these plans, right? Like, what should these GSAs be expecting now when the state comes back with feedback?
Yeah. Okay. So that first round of assessments that the DWR did was back in June, and it caused a huge ripple, you know, because that's the first time that anybody saw what the state was really going to be demanding of these GSPs, and, you know, how they were going to be receiving what they what the GSAs had written up, because that is where the rubber meets the road. That's where they have to jump back in and try and fix deficiencies. Because even though Sigma sounded really draconian when it first kind of came out, like you're going to write these GSPs. And if these GSPs are found to be deficient, then the state's going to come in and basically, you know, take the handle of your pump away from you. I mean, that's really kind of the way it was kind of set up. Really what's happening is DWR is going through and giving these assessments and giving an example of what the cure could be. And then the GSA, the Groundwater Sustainability Agency, can then, if it so chooses, redo its work and say, okay, here we go. Here's what we are going to submit to say how we're going to cure what deficiencies you found. So it's going to be more of a give and take thing before it becomes, you know, the hammer coming down.
So these GSAs had to submit their plans, these GSPs, a couple of years ago now at this point. What have they been up to in the meantime? I mean, they didn't have to wait and sit idly until the state came back with plans, right? They were allowed to actually start implementing some of the projects that they listed in these plans?
Yes, they were actually encouraged to start implementing projects to start, you know, addressing groundwater overdraft. And some of them have, like Madera County, you know, they are moving forward with their plans quite, you know, methodically and fairly quickly in the world of GSAs. In the meantime, however, there's been this little thing called a drought. And so there's been this, you know, just sort of, you know, everybody's all hands on deck to try and survive this last 2 years where it's gotten to be just so dry. And try as they might, there's no extra water to be putting onto the ground to try and recharge aquifers. And so you're already seeing places hit their minimum thresholds. You know, minimum threshold is sort of like, just think of it as the red line below which we shall not go, because if we go below this line, we're going to see really bad things happen, like domestic wells starting to go dry, or, you know, well casings being crushed, or land sinking, you know. And so we've already started to hit minimum thresholds in numerous places in the valley. Tulare Irrigation District, I believe, had some minimum thresholds near Teveston, which you reported on it. Numerous people reported on it. Teveston went dry earlier this year in the summertime. And we've seen numerous wells going dry up in the Madera area, and, you know, increase in pollutants, because once the groundwater drops, you have an increase in concentration of pollutants. So we're seeing these problems, and it's not because people are ignoring Sigma. It's because we are caught up in this, you know, massive and epically dry drought.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so you've already mentioned a lot of GSAs to kind of look out for. You've mentioned a lot of contentious issues. I mean, there's recharge basins. There are areas that don't have any surface water at all to be able to do any creative projects with, these white areas. There are, you know, water markets that could be popping up in certain areas. So as the state comes back with its feedback for these GSPs, also as this drought continues, I mean, what are some of the areas that you're going to be keeping an eye on, or that you think are important to keep an eye on, that will kind of encapsulate kind of where the future is with Sigma and where the interesting things will be happening?
Well, I think water markets are definitely something to keep an eye on. So far, most of the places that I've seen have talked about doing water markets within their own GSA, so that their farmers can trade around within their own GSA and, you know, I'll give you my credits this year and, you know, I won't pump and you'll pay me some amount of money and, you know, we'll both survive whatever dry year. And it is really, most of them are based on dry year scenarios, especially in like Rosedale Rio Bravo, which was the first one to create an accounting, a water accounting platform that all of its growers could access. And then with the idea that that would then be used as a potential trading platform if they ever hit minimum thresholds and dry years, mm-hmm. which we're already in. So, so those things are good. I have seen other GSAs where the growers within those GSAs have been asking about water marketing outside the GSA. And that potentially could be a problem that I think that a lot of domestic well owners would be interested in, because they don't have the capacity to move a lot of their groundwater. They don't want to move their groundwater. They want to use their groundwater for domestic uses and for growth. at the city level. So those markets are going to be really interesting to see, like, how is that going to be fleshed out, and what are the rules of Sigma going to be? And that gets into even beyond the GSAs, because some counties, numerous counties, have rules that you cannot move native groundwater beyond the county borders. So those things are going to be very interesting to see. And we at SJV Water, we even did a story here recently that a number of rural areas that need housing, they're already in a housing crunch. The groundwater and lack of water infrastructure is stymieing the interest of any housing developers to come in. I didn't touch on the issue of small farmers. You're starting to see small farmers potentially basically not priced out, but watered out, I guess, groundwatered out of the mix. Because if you're a big farmer, you know, 20,000 acres, 10,000 acres, whatever, you can probably fallow some percentage of your land and then use that groundwater associated with that land to keep your other crops going and thriving. But if you're a truly small farmer, you don't have the land to be able to do that. And so I've been talking to a lot of small farmers, especially in the Kings County area, that are really concerned about the future.
Yeah. Well, and then of course, another issue with Sigma too is the administrative, like, costs of putting together all this paperwork or being involved in your GSA is also, those are some barriers to small farmers getting involved and being able to, you know, claim their stake in the process as well.
Yeah. Small farmers don't have water departments. Like larger corporate farmers have full departments where someone can, you know, be at every meeting and have something to say. And small farmers, a lot of them don't even know what's happening in their area. So I think that's a real detriment that I wish the state would be able to do something about. I'm not, you know, smart enough to know what that is, but I'd like to see the small farmers survive and thrive. And so Sigma and this valley are going to be tied at the hip, and things are going to be changing dramatically, I think, in the next 10 years.
Absolutely. Very interesting. Lots of things afoot, lots of things to keep an eye out for. So this is Lois Henry, the CEO and editor of sjvwater.org. Lois, thanks so much for talking with me.
All right. Well, thanks, Carrie, for checking in.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Shock. Fresno poet Mai Derfang looks back on a dark chapter of history in her new collection, Yellow Rain. Hmong refugees fleeing Laos at the end of the Vietnam War reported being attacked with chemical and biological weapons that led to thousands of deaths. But American scientists dismissed the refugees' accounts, claiming that the mysterious substance raining down on them was the feces of honeybees. Through exhaustive research of once classified documents, Vang reveals the truth of what happened, giving voice to the victims of the attacks. I spoke to Vang about how she uncovered their forgotten stories.
I was inspired and sort of taken to this project when I learned about Yellow Rain many, many years ago during my undergraduate studies. And something about the issue of Yellow Rain stayed with me all of these years, decades later now. And then finally in 2012, there was an episode that aired on the radio show and podcast Radiolab that featured Hmong writer Khao Kalia Ying and her uncle, who were there to talk about Yellow Rain. But it didn't turn out to be the experience that they had anticipated, only because the hosts of the show had sort of had a different way of thinking and talking about Yellow Rain and weren't really there, it seemed, to hear them out on their experiences. And so the show just stopped midway and Kalia ended the interview. And after that episode aired, there was just a firestorm of response from listeners who were alarmed and upset and enraged by the outcome of the interview. And for me, it just reignited this fury and this fire to really dig in and dive into Yellow Rain.
Let's talk about that process for you. I have to say the amount of research you did for this collection is phenomenal. And it really blurs the line between a work of poetry and a work of, I think of it as journalism or documentary and history. Can you talk about why it was so necessary for you to do such a deep dive?
The research was instrumental to my process because it really helped me to figure out the various branches of ideas and thinking that were involved in the larger discourse of Yellow Rain. And for me, being part of this new and exciting field of docu-poetics has helped me to think about how to shape this work. And I say that keeping in mind too that docu-poetry is not necessarily new. People have been doing this kind of work for decades now where they've been integrating archival research into their literary and creative work. But for me, I think it was instrumental because the research really helps to ground a new way of thinking about what happened with Yellow Rain. When most people had talked about Yellow Rain in the past, it was to really, you know, hear the testimonies or to look at what the government reports were saying. But there weren't access to those documents back then, 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when it was all happening. And so over the course of time and through the Freedom of Information Act, which allowed these documents to become released, the information is now available. And so for me, it was just so important to be able to tie that into the work that I was doing creatively and to find ways of offering a counter narrative.
Can you talk about your choice to integrate so many visual elements into this work?
Yeah, the visuals, for starters, really helped to immerse the reader in the experience that I went through too. Just seeing the watermarks, the gradients, the redactions, being immersed in that really sets a kind of tone for what was revealed and what was not revealed at all. And for me during this process and what is revealed and what may not be revealed for the reader in some ways. So I thought that integrating those visuals would allow for a kind of immersive experience to come through for the reader, to not only read the text, but also to see the ways in which that text either veiled or unveiled particular information. And then also, I think that for me, working within a framework of visual poetics, or trying to at least, I was also interested in the arrangement of text on a page and how through that arrangement, a kind of narrative comes through, or how through that arrangement, there is a way to offer a particular lens into what I'm trying to say. And so I'm looking at various ways to think about, as a poet, spatiality on the page and, you know, aligning words with each other or separating them, considering their proximity allows me to think more deeply about their spatial interaction too on the page. So for me, I think it was twofold. It was sort of the craft and poetic aspect of working with language and text on a page, but it was also then the other aspect of what happens when you bring certain words together on a page and what kind of narrative that can conjure.
I have to imagine that writing about this history that has been silenced for so long, that has been not believed, must have changed the stakes of this work for you as a poet.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just, I didn't anticipate setting out to do this in the first place. And I couldn't have anticipated the directions in which this work was going to take me in the way that many people who are writers or even artists can't predict where the work will take them in the end. Because of the secrecy involved with the secret war and then the devastation and the scandal that unfolded around Yellow Rain, the stakes are and continue to be high for me as a Hmong writer, as a daughter of refugees who continues to contend with these histories.
What do you hope readers take from this collection, and how do you hope this book is positioned in our understanding of our history as Americans?
Well, I hope that what the book provides for readers is, you know, at the most basic fundamental level, that they learn about what Yellow Rain was. And through that, maybe they've never even heard of Hmong people, but they then also learn who Hmong people are and the sort of traumatic and devastating military history that the Hmong people have played in relationship to the United States, you know, stemming from the U.S. wars in Laos and Vietnam. And I also hope that what readers take will be a sense of curiosity and desire to reckon with their own histories or histories within their own communities that need to be reckoned with, that maybe haven't deserved the public moment that it deserves. And I really hope that readers are able to draw that out on their own, just being able, if they're, you know, reading my work and sensing that it's important to reckon with these histories and to bring them out into a public space so that there can be larger discourse and greater understanding about what happened and about ways in which some of these things cannot and should not be erased.
Would you mind reading a selection from the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a poem that sort of sets up the beginning of the book and helps to prepare the reader for what's to come. Guide for the channeling. Toward a worn legacy of rain, I have been lost down every jungle path, adrift and senseless to split open a cascade of knowing. I have tried with all my limber to keen a credo of justice, shelter those who solace inside graves. I have been boiled in my bladed search, opening with questions of a deserted pain to end with a cemented breath shattered into silk. This is where I am taking you, into a discarded vista blowing forth a silent blaze. Here in sunk villages of the disregarded. Here where even the dirt of the land cannot muster against the threat of air. Biomedical, vegetation, munitions unfound, every footprint incarnate. Where highlands tangle their echoes to the land, a place no matter how remote will always be too near and too much a reminder of an expired war. Refugees not called as people, only to be called the outcome of an event. We are venturing into swell beyond swelling of paperwork and protocol, slips of memo and routing, cable and classified meeting. Here is the talk, biological weapon, yellow spots, apiary blame for decades to wane and cold filed. Believe me as a torch of this wandering that I have been digging within the origins of redaction. Believe where I am sending you. I have been shoveling upside down, and now my eyes stagger, my hands ache, my legs becoming hunter, my back a raging shadow. I have been gardening myself into this remembrance.
I've been talking with Mai Der Vang, author of the new collection of poetry, Yellow Rain. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.